Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. I think you got a pretty good preview of what I'm going to be talking about from the introduction. I might say that I want to start out by saying, in fact, that I'm not a philosopher at all. I disclaim any competence in that technical area. And so I'm not really in a position to take on the question of redeeming reason as a speculative issue. What I want to do is simply give you a descriptive account of the historical experience of American Catholics in higher education and how the question of redeeming reason played out there, in the hope that it'll have some relevance for the concerns of evangelical Christians. For two generations, Catholic educators believed they had successfully redeemed reason by adopting neo-scholastic philosophy as a school philosophy. You're talking about talk will have two parts. First, I'm going to trace the role played by neo-scholasticism, also known as scholasticism, scholastic philosophy, Thomism, or neo-Thomism, in Catholic higher education, and that'll be 9/10 of it. After that, I'll make a few very brief comments on what possible relevance this might have for the project of redeeming reason as it presents itself to evangelicals. The great revival of scholastic philosophy began in the middle decades of the 19th century in Italy primarily, received decisive impetus in 1879 when the Pope Leo XIII issued an encyclical called Aeterni Patris. This document exhorted Catholics to return to the golden wisdom of St. Thomas. In the encyclical, the Pope stressed the philosophy of St. Thomas, because most of the evils of the modern world, social and political as well as religious, in the Pope's view, could be traced back to a misuse of human reason. The Thomistic version of Aristotelianism could not only aid in overcoming these evils, it would also furnish a stepping stone to faith by demonstrating that God is. And at the same time, it would lend to theology what the encyclical described as the nature, form, and genus of a true science, by providing the speculative principles whereby the data of revelation could be organized and grasped as a synthetic whole. This papal initiative was a key turning point in the whole revival. But scholastic philosophy did not immediately become the centerpiece, the curricular centerpiece in Catholic colleges in this country. The primary reason was that the colleges were not yet at that time organized in such a way as to make possible the effective incorporation of the revival. They were still predominantly secondary level schools, theoretically committed to classical languages as the basic content of real education. As a matter of fact, Catholic educators were so completely absorbed by organizational and curricular problems in between the 1880s and 1920s that they had little time to worry about philosophy in the course of studies. The fundamental problem here, that is in terms of curriculum and organization, was that the old-time Catholic college, the Catholic college of the 19th century, of which there were about 100 more or less in 1900, the old-time Catholic college was like the German gymnasium or the French lycée. That is, it combined secondary studies, secondary level studies, and the lower level of collegiate studies in one continuous 6 or 7 year program. That arrangement obviously didn't fit at all with the prevailing American system, whereby the two levels of secondary and collegiate education were held in distinct institutions. This organizational anomaly, had been there since the beginning, the first Catholic college being Georgetown, established as an academy in 1789. But in the 19th century, practically all colleges had prep divisions, and so it was less of a problem. However, in the late 19th century, with the multiplication of free public school high schools, and with the introduction of what were called new subjects, that is history, modern languages, English, the Catholic colleges could no longer effectively continue to straddle these two levels of education, which had become an institutional divide that all educators were concerned about at the turn of the century, of distinguishing where does the high school leave off and the college begin. That's why the College Entrance Board was set up at that time, and the various regional accrediting associations came into being at that time. So for Catholic colleges, what was a problem for all of educators, secondary and collegiate, was a crisis. They had to do one of three things. Either become what was called a standard college, drop down to high school level, or go out of business. How they dealt with this crisis is quite a fascinating story, but it's something we can't get into here. All we need to say is that the process took approximately 20 years, two decades, and resulted in the modernization of Catholic institutions of higher education. Modernization, that is, putting them into the shape that would be recognizable to us as what a college ought to look like. That meant, among other things, eliminating secondary level students, accepting the credit hour system, which had been brought into being as part of the larger reorganization going on, accepting the elective principle, accepting majors and minors, and specialization of learning embodied in academic departments, and introducing a great variety of vocational courses, the latter often being associated with the college's upgrading itself to university level by adding professional programs in law, medicine, pharmacy, journalism, music, and so on. By the time they completed the process in the 1920s, Catholic colleges were ready to incorporate neo-scholasticism, and there were several conditions that made it particularly timely at that point. First of these, and the most important, was that papal policy in respect to the revival of scholasticism had shifted from exhortation to rigorous enforcement. This change dated primarily, or most significantly, from Pope Pius X's condemnation of the theological deviation known as modernism in 1907. When, in anathematizing modernism, the synthesis of all heresies, as the Pope called it, he observed that it sprang from the union between faith and false philosophy. Contemptuous of scholasticism, the modernists had embraced modern philosophy with all its false glamour, and therefore placed the faith in grave jeopardy. Their ideas were vehemently proscribed, and to make sure that nothing of the kind ever happened again, the Pope strictly ordained that scholastic philosophy be made the basis of the sacred sciences. And to remove any lingering ambiguity, he added, and let it be clearly understood that when we prescribe scholastic philosophy, we understand chiefly that of the angelic doctor, that is St. Thomas, what the angelic doctor has bequeathed us. All the ordinances of the previous Pope, Leo XIII, were reaffirmed to be strictly observed in Catholic seminaries. And then Pius himself went on to say, professors of philosophy and theology court grave peril if they deviate so much as a step from Aquinas. This emphatic requirement was formalized in 1917 with the promulgation of a code of canon law, which specified that professors of the sacred sciences were to adhere religiously to the method, doctrines, and principles of St. Thomas. In addition, the then reigning pope, that is Benedict XV, stated, the church has proclaimed the doctrine of St. Thomas is her own. In 1923, the next pope, his successor Pius XI, elaborated that point and enumerated the various relevances of St. Thomas's work, among other things, observing he, Thomas, defended the value and power of human reason and proved by unquestionably valid arguments the existence of God. By the 1920s, Catholics were then religiously obligated to follow St. Thomas. The obligation was laid most stringently upon seminaries, but it applied to colleges too. This brings us to the second factor, this change in papal policies. First, the second factor that made its adoption particularly timely. Point is that by the 1920s, the colleges had completed their organizational modernization and were therefore in a position to translate the papal mandate to on St. Thomas, translate it into up-to-date credit hour requirements in scholastic philosophy. And this they did with a vengeance. By the early 30s, even Catholic women's colleges, and women were thought to be less adapted for heavy philosophic studies, even Catholic women's colleges required an average of 12 to 14 hours of neo-scholastic philosophy for their undergraduates. Okay, there's the third factor which comes into play also in the 1920s, is that having completed this also has to do with their recently completed modernization. Because in that process, Catholic educators had adopted so many of the forms and practices of the secular academy that they were worried about losing their religious identity altogether. Hence, they welcomed neo-scholastic philosophy, and I stress we're talking about philosophy, not theology, because it supplied a rational basis for faith and thereby provided collegians with a grounding for their religious beliefs in keeping with their status as thinking adults rather than children who took matters on the filioistic basis. The fourth consideration making the immersion so timely in the 20s was that because it synthesized faith and reason, neo-scholasticism constituted a unifying principle for all knowledge and could therefore serve as the integrating principle for a curriculum that had been fragmented by the changes introduced as part of the modernizing process. Because the old view was that the prescribed curriculum was what education really was, and the adoption of electives and just listing courses helter-skelter seemed to the educators, Catholic educators at that time, as an abdication of true learning, of true of their pedagogical responsibilities. So they were happy to have philosophy serve as a way that they could put the curriculum back together as a unity. Fifth point is that natural law, which was an integral feature of neo-scholasticism, had applications in politics, social teaching, family, and ethics in general. Hence, it could not only serve as a personal philosophy of life, it also furnished the cognitive basis for a truly humane culture in the larger society. Finally, this is sixth and last, by 1930, American Catholics were beginning to see themselves as part of a great intellectual and cultural movement centered in Europe, which had grown up around and to some extent stimulated by the scholastic revival. This Catholic Renaissance, as it was sometimes called, included literary and artistic figures like G.K. Chesterton, Sigurd Undset, Paul Claudel, Georges Rouault. But for American Catholics, its best known representatives were the philosophers Jacques Maritain and Etienne Gilson. Likewise well known was the historian Christopher Dawson. His argument, Dawson's argument, that religion constituted the basic element of all the great world cultures meshed neatly with Catholic educators' understanding of their cultural task. That is, to replace the secularism of the surrounding world, the surrounding culture, that dominated American intellectual life with a truly Christian culture. So this recital then is the factors that accounted for its being neo-scholasticism's being established as the unifying principle and the cognitive foundation of Catholic colleges' religious identity, which it was from the 1920s then through the 1950s. What was its substance and how did it function? Broadly speaking, and that's all I'm going to do, I mean, I'm not going to recite or review for you the contents of the neo-scholastic system. Broadly speaking, neo-scholasticism was Aristotelian realism as modified and brought into harmony with Christian belief by St. Thomas. So without attempting to summarize it further, and actually, I don't think very many educated Catholics of the era I'm talking about could have gone a whole lot further in summarizing it. That is to say, few really knew it in a systematic and deep way. But experts who could elaborate it and who could justify it and who could explain it were believed to exist. In other words, my argument is neo-scholasticism served for Catholics, for literate Catholics, as a systematic backup for their overall view of reality. Something that properly qualified specialists could deploy if need be. Let me repeat that in a slightly different form, because it's a key idea, I think. Neo-scholasticism constituted the technical philosophical system that could be called upon to explain, justify, and elaborate the interlinked but technically informal set of beliefs Catholics held concerning the nature of reality, the meaning of human existence, and the implications of these beliefs for personal morality, social ethics, political policy, and so on. Understood in this sense, Catholic worldview, there's that word, Catholic worldview is closely related to Catholic faith, but covers more ground than would be included in the definition of faith itself. The main outlines of the worldview as it meshed with neo-scholasticism seem to me to be the following. Most basically, neo-scholasticism buttressed religious faith because it reconciled faith and natural reason. Not only did it accord with the teachings of the church, it purported to prove Catholics' most basic belief that there is a God, on the basis of reason alone. Some neo-scholastics carried their rationalism to the point of denying that God's existence could be an act of faith because it was known, because it was provable and therefore known rather than believed. The standard view, however, distinguished between supernatural faith, for which grace was required, and the preambles of faith, which were established by natural reason, but which included God's existence and dim analogical inklings of the divine nature. Thus we find a mid-century, that is early 1950s, college theology book beginning its elaborate discussion of the act of faith with a reminder that the preambles of faith had already been scientifically proven in our course in philosophy. Okay, so, proving the reconciling faith and reason is the first linkage between the worldview and scholastic system as such. Second, neo-scholasticism underlay Catholics' more generalized confidence in the power of human reason, which was a prominent feature of their outlook on the world. Catholic writers never tired of contrasting their confidence in intelligence, which they meant the capacity of the human mind to grasp objective reality and to deal with it discursively and to arrive at objective truth. Never tired of contrasting their confidence in intelligence, understood that way, with the subjectivism, pragmatism, and relativism of modern thinkers. Taken for granted quality of Catholic confidence in reason is tellingly captured in G.K. Chesterton's story, The Blue Cross, in which his fictional detective, Father Brown, spots an imposter by observing that a man passing himself off as a priest spoke slightingly of reason. Other features of the system particularly relevant to higher education have already been noted, such as the neo-scholasticism's potential for serving as a personal philosophy of life, integrating principle in the curriculum, and formative role in shaping the larger culture. So I'll give you a couple of citations here, quotations. One leading Catholic scholar was a Jesuit geophysicist, hailed scholastic philosophy as, quote, a stable, universal, certain system of thought, a real philosophy of life, to which students can anchor all their views and thoughts and knowledge. About the same time, that was around 1930, a Jesuit philosopher noted that neo-scholasticism, here's the quotation, has very definite relations to the whole of Catholic thought and a very definite value in building up a Catholic worldview. As such, it makes possible a unity of thought and a singleness of outlook on reality. A key element of the Catholic worldview, closely related to the culture-forming dimension of neo-scholasticism, was its synthesizing power, the way it reduced all things to unity, to intelligible order. One well-known preacher at the time said that in the Middle Ages, people were distinguished by learning if they knew only a few things. The more things were reduced to order, the more educated you were. So the idea of bringing everything together was a very key issue. By synthesizing natural truth and supernatural revelation, neo-scholasticism made it possible to see all the facts of life in their true relationship to God, to history, to the human family in general. This view found florid expression from Peter Gilday, who was the leading American Catholic historian at the time. In 1928, he said, "Catholics' belief in God, in the purpose of creation, in man's original fall and its consequences, and in man's final destiny, enables them to see, even as in a glass darkly, the magnificent unity of life, the stupendously intricate weave of the warp and woof of human existence, the all-embracing divine guidance of a world which was created to know God, to love God, to serve God in this life in order to be happy with him in the next. Now, Gilday was not a philosopher, quite unspeculative, actually, but he was speaking in this, you know, popular pietistic terms was based on the assumption that neo-scholasticism provided the rational grounding for this whole cosmic unity. Connected with this is the admiration for the Middle Ages, references to which were so frequent in Catholic writing that you might almost call medievalism a feature of the Catholic worldview. But it's really better understood as a manifestation of this near obsession with order and unity. For what made the medieval epoch so appealing was the model it supposedly provided of a harmoniously unified society, suffused by the Catholic spirit and structured according to the Catholic view of reality. Nor was it an accident, as Catholics saw it, that it was in this era that St. Thomas and the other schoolmen worked out the system of thought that articulated this unity at the highest level of abstraction. The true source of medieval unity was, of course, God, and what Catholics thought of as the God-centeredness of human thought, belief, and striving in that age of faith. The same outlook was a key element in the Catholic worldview of the period of between the wars and into the mid-century. That is, an intense God-centeredness, an emphasis upon the supernatural, an insistence on seeing all things sub specie eternitatis, under the aspect of eternity. That underlay the whole movement of the Catholic revival and constituted one of its most essential features. It obviously involved a great deal more than just rationality as such. That was extremely important, of course, and central to neo-scholasticism. But God's being did more than illuminate the human intellect. Once understood, the divine plan for humankind required action, a commitment to its fulfillment on the part of every believer. Beyond that, God's infinite perfection simultaneously awakened spiritual longings that could only be satisfied by personal union with God. So we have a merging of cognitive, moral, and affective reactions arising from the effort to penetrate more deeply to the philosophical understanding. This is captured, the way this emerges is captured in one of the classic spiritual autobiographies of the era. In Raissa Maritain's We Have Been Friends Together, the wife of the most famous representative of the Catholic Renaissance recalled her first reading of St. Thomas with these words: "Praying to understand was for me one and the same thing. The one made me thirst for the other, and that thirst in me I felt to be constantly and yet never quenched." So from the 1920s through the 1950s, neo-scholastic philosophy reigned supreme in Catholic colleges and universities in this country. Theology was a subject confined to seminaries until the 1960s, basically, and religion, which was taught beginning in the 20s, but only getting started as an academic subject in the 20s, was never able to establish itself as an effective curricular competitor to philosophy. In those days, philosophy was taught on a mass basis and constituted the academic justification for Catholic colleges' claim to a distinctive religious identity. It reached its climax in the early 1950s, but came under increasing criticism in that decade. And by the late 1960s, neoscholasticism, or by that time usually called Thomism, was completely displaced from its former hegemonic place in the curriculum. Between the early 50s and the late 60s, it just lost out. What happened? This has never been really investigated with deep thoroughness, the question. However, you can see certain interrelated factors that have played a part in this sudden falling apart. First, there was increasing criticism about the way it was taught. It was all but inevitable in view of its being a required subject taught to vast numbers of undergraduates. In the mid-1950s at Notre Dame, approximately 2,400 students a semester were taking philosophy courses. No system of thought could be purveyed on this scale without being vulgarized in the process. The same point applied to the teaching staff, which required, of course, a very large teaching staff, not all of whom were adequately prepared, and whose teaching loads were very heavy. 12 hours a semester was the norm into the 1960s. The result was undue reliance on textbooks, too much use of objective tests, complaints from students that philosophy was nothing but memory work. Other complaints centered on the intellectual texture of the material as it came through to students, its dryness, formalistic quality, remoteness from the present, a lack of clear reference to other subjects in the curriculum which it was supposed to integrate. By the end of the decade, warnings about seminary methods and condescending references to nostalgia for the Middle Ages had become practically routine. Thomism was, in short, well on its way to being dismissed by Catholics themselves as an official ideology, the teaching of which amounted to little more than indoctrination in the party line. Unfortunately, such criticism was all too often justified. For as the Catholic publisher Frank Sheed once observed, many professors treated neoscholastic philosophy as material not to be examined by reason, but to be swallowed as dogma. A second major source of dissatisfaction, in a sense, belies the official ideology charge, because it arose from disagreements among neoscholastics themselves, Catholic philosophers themselves, about how Thomism was to be understood. Historical studies, which had been given a great boost by Leo's call for renewal of Thomism, dated back to the late 19th century. And by the 1950s, it had clearly established that thought of St. Thomas himself and of the other schoolmen of the era, was far richer and more complex than the pioneers of the revival had dreamed. The result was what one writer called a Thomistic spectrum that embraced 12 variations of Thomism sufficiently different to require separate treatment in different chapters of her book. Nor were these differences inconsequential, for I've lost page 11. Have to wing it. They weren't inconsequential in as much as one version held that Thomism required pluralism, another denied that pluralism was possible. So, still another difficulty was that one group had begun to call the Thomistic philosophy a Christian philosophy. This seemed dangerous because if it was a Christian philosophy, that meant it wasn't based on reason alone, but it smuggled in religious assumptions, and therefore the claim to establish its truth on the basis of philosophical reasoning alone was incorrect. So by the, that was all in place by the 1960. Then came the Second Vatican Council, sessions of which held between 1962 and 65, the result of which was a broad wholesale rethinking of Catholic discipline, doctrine, morality, and general outlook. And in that context, neo-scholasticism simply collapsed. It fell apart like a house of cards. Now, I don't mean to say that I'm not making a judgment about it, its validity, because I don't know how to do that. What I'm saying is that it just completely lost its position of hegemonic curricular importance and its claim to be the foundation of Catholic distinctiveness, giving it an academic claim. That is, what was the point, people were asking by the mid-60s, of a Catholic university or Catholic college, the professors of which operated on the same principles as others, and whose results did not differ in any particular way. That is, what was the academic justification for a Catholic institution? You used to be able to say, because we have this philosophic understanding which furnishes the whole framework. Now that wasn't there anymore. Now, I somehow mix these pages up, and so I'm not quite sure that I'll be able to, here we go, at least in part. That pretty much is what I want to say about the rise and fall. Before the 1920s, Catholics did, of course, teach philosophy in their college classes, but it wasn't the same, it didn't make the same kind of broad claim to be the capstone and the integrating force of everything. It did play that role for two generations, and then it broke apart. It doesn't anymore. There are Catholic philosophers and other philosophers who presently, for instance, Alistair MacIntyre gave a talk a couple of years ago in which he basically said Catholic institutions should put St. Thomas back in as the central piece of the curriculum and make their claims on that basis. It was tried. That was what was objected. The point was made at the talk, the session where he gave that talk. Anyhow, that's the Catholic ups, the Catholic up and down. What has this got to do with the interests of evangelical Christians concerned with redeeming reason? Well, that's a question that properly would be, taken up from that angle. But let me call attention to a couple of points. First, the respect, that is, I want to say, what does this example of what Catholics had to do, tried to do and did do, say about the project of redeeming reason? Well, first thing about it is that it's quite obvious that the role of centralized authority in the two traditions, Catholic and evangelical, is very different. It would be very much more difficult for evangelicals to impose any system of thought as thoroughly, not say monolithically, as happened in the case of Catholics and neo-scholasticism. As everyone knows, centralized authority is one of the principal distinguishing features of Roman Catholicism. In the case at hand, papal authority was absolutely essential to giving the thought of St. Thomas its hegemonic character and in enforcing its acceptance, so stringently. A distinguishable but related condition has to do with the historic role of religious communities in Catholic higher education. I'm referring to the fact that religious communities were in charge of the very great majority, all but about a dozen, of the Catholic colleges and universities, of which there were by in the 1950s, at the peak somewhere around between 250 and 300. Since the members of religious communities are vowed to religious obedience, they're subject to ecclesiastical authority in ways that do not apply to laypersons. Moreover, neo-scholasticism was a key element in the historic traditions of two of the religious communities, the Jesuits and the Dominicans. The latter, the Dominicans, had few colleges of their own, but they were important theorists, background theorists, you might say. The Jesuits, on the other hand, were by far the most important order engaged in higher education, and they had been committed to Thomism since the days of St. Ignatius in the 16th century. So there was a kind of double influence at work there. Now I'm still looking for one more page. So these two things, the role of authority and the role of religious communities, suggest it would be much more difficult for evangelicals to emulate the Catholic example, the experience of which might also have some cautionary value. For what the Catholic example shows is that adopting and enforcing an official school philosophy creates problems of its own. It obviously forecloses other intellectual possibilities and introduces an unhealthy degree or an unhealthy element of rigidity, even if it doesn't degenerate into an ideology in the pejorative sense of that term. To the degree that it's wholeheartedly accepted, sincerely accepted, it's almost bound to result in a premature closure on truth, and to nurture the complacent assumption that all the questions that really matter have already been settled. Most dangerously, perhaps, it overextends and overdetermines religious faith, and in doing so, makes the faith more brittle. This was touched upon by John Courtney Murray in a statement he made in 1944. He said that the unity and solidity of the Catholic edifice of doctrine was important in itself and had spiritual worth for those who studied it, but it also was self-reinforcing. Each part was made stronger by being part of the whole. Now, if error is admitted, he said, it would challenge the whole, not a single truth, but the whole of the edifice, the whole edifice of the Catholic corpus doctrinae. He said that in 1944, and at the time that was considered to be, I mean, he gave no hint that this was a real possibility. This hypothetical thing would never happen. Error wouldn't be admitted. But of course, by the late 1950s, and certainly in the 1960s, error was admitted in the sense that Catholics had decided that they had made a number of mistakes in the past. And once one part is called into question, if it's all a synthesis, the whole thing is called into question. So one of the strengths of that kind of system, at any rate, was had seeds of its own destruction. Someone said that all belief aspires to the condition of rational belief. Maybe that's a commonplace among philosophers. I'm not a philosopher, but it makes sense to me. And I'm fully persuaded that redeeming reason and reconciling faith and reason are goals devoutly to be wished. At the same time, the experience of American Catholics stands as witness, I think, to the difficulty of the task and some of the perils it entails. Thank you. Yes, sir.
Thank you. Could you comment about your perceptions of what's happened, say, in the hear John Paul's papacy and the present. It seems to me that there's been both a sense of how bad things got in the 60s and 70s, and then something of a renewal in certain places. And I just wonder how you would do
that. Yes, I'd be glad to comment on that. And understanding this not has to do with philosophy, because I don't know what the philosophers are doing. But I think you're quite right. It's been 40 years since the council closed, and the Second Vatican Council. Many people say that the changes that were coming about in the church have been in process for a long time. They were movements in the 50s and 60s, and the processes of social assimilation were such that Catholics were becoming more like others in the American society generally. True, but the council had a profound effect. It had a very great effect, and it destroyed what had been the assumption before that the truth, the Catholic Church has the truth, it's one, always the same, never changes, won't change. It appeared to be changing. And therefore, if it changed a little, it could change a lot more. So there was what was called the post-conciliar spirit, in which the notion that a number of things were still left too unsettled by the council, and we should move ahead. So that there was a period from the mid-60s through the mid or late 70s, just when nothing was ruled out as too radical, too liberal, too wild. And as far as Catholic colleges were concerned, the colleges were, of course, under practically monastic discipline, in the sense that the administration was run on the basis of basically religious obedience up through the 1950s, so that there was a good deal of subsurface dissatisfaction among the faculties and among the students, and there was a kind of sense of liberation, and we don't want to go back to the parochial narrow rigidity of the past. It's time for us to open up. And the opening up led to things such as we see today, with a great deal of richness of ecumenical understanding, cooperation that never was there in the past. But the sort of anything goes spirit in Catholic higher education virtually immediately, because by the late 1960s, people were talking about an identity crisis. Of course, everybody was talking about an identity crisis in the 60s, but this was rampant. And by the early 70s, people were beginning to think, we have got to do something to reaffirm our religious commitment. And that effort was reinforced beginning in the mid 70s by good old papal authority, because the educators were basically saying to religious to Rome, don't worry, it's under control, we'll take care of it, us administrators have got to just leave it to us. And Rome increasingly said, fine, but how are you going to do it? Let's see it spelled out. And so from the mid-70s through the early 90s, there was a kind of, what's the historian who studied this calls it, a bilateral dialogue, which consisted of Rome insisting on more and more, explicit attention to reaffirming the religious identity and making that real through various operational ways. That culminated in the encyclical from the Ex Corde Ecclesiae in 1990 from John Paul II. And since then, it seems to me there has been a greater recognition, more systematic efforts, and a more effective attention to the need to reestablish reestablish the religious dimension and to make it effective. So yes, I think that's going on now. Yes.
What is the status and place of Thomism, say, in a Catholic university that advertises itself, for lack of a better word, as, you know, following the Jesuit tradition today? Can you infer anything in general from that or not?
No. The question is, what would the Thomistic thing mean in a place that says it's following the Jesuit tradition? First of all, the use of this, the Jesuit tradition, the Franciscan tradition, the Vincentian charism, that kind of thing, or the way the institutions tended to advertise themselves not as Catholic but as Jesuit, or Franciscan, or Mercy Sister, or Benedictine, was because Catholic was a harder sell. So, you know, people can think of Francis and very unoffensive, whereas Catholic tended to put people off. The Jesuits, the Jesuits are they have about 28 institutions, and they have by far the largest number that have large professional programs, large graduate programs, and so on. They're the pace setters. They're the ones whose tradition goes back to their Ratio Studiorum. The plan was worked out 1599. And so they were the ones who were sort of the model educators all the way through. Now, after the council, the Jesuits became very much more oriented toward social action, toward social justice, peace and social justice. And from the middle 70s on, some of the Jesuit institutions promoted the social action projects, that is, extracurricular projects, and programs of study as really what constitutes our new identity. I mean, this is what Catholics should be doing. We want to overcome oppression and poverty, bring peace, reconcile hostilities. This is what a Christian should do. And therefore, if we do this, and if we make this our central thing, that will take care of all, if we do that, Catholic identity will take care of itself. That's been a very strong thing among the Jesuits, but where Thomism fits in the picture, I don't know. The Jesuits were, the Jesuits had by far the most effective, largest number of people in working in philosophy in the before the Vatican Council, and St. Louis University was the best school as far as their Jesuit, as far as Catholic philosophy departments probably was concerned. But they also followed up lines that were among those variations of the scholastic method in the 1940s and 50s. Where it all stands now, I just don't know. But it isn't what makes the Jesuit place Catholic anymore. Yeah. Back in the back? Okay. Yeah.
You talked about this time in the middle of this century when at Notre Dame you had 24 students taking philosophy classes each semester. 24 academic things, which is, I've heard stories, I've never heard a figure like that.
Yeah, well, so there were probably about 7,000 or 8,000 undergraduates.
Yeah.
And if they have to take 12 hours of philosophy, you know, yeah, it works out.
And I understand how that's tied to the role that Thomism at the time played in the curriculum. In Catholic philosophy departments today, you know, except for the smaller ones, like at Steubenville or Christendom, Thomism is not studied by the majority of the professors anymore. It's not the specialty. It's always a minority of the professors who study Thomas. And but there's still a philosophy requirement for undergrad. I think at Notre Dame it's two. Undergrads have to take two philosophy classes. At Catholic University, where I'm a student, I guess it's three. At Fordham, even at Villanova, which whose philosophy department is very anti-Thomistic, they have, they require a certain number of philosophy classes. Is this just sort of a kind of a relic, a derivative of, this is going to go away in a couple decades? Catholic universities will require no philosophy classes of its undergrads.
Not if the philosophy departments have anything to say about it.
Well, have you heard articulated by these universities another good reason to require undergrads to take?
Oh, they can always have good reasons. No, I mean, it seems to me, it's the historic derivative of this, piling on of courses that made sense in the minds of the educators when it was done. It's been reduced, surely, but the required courses are a very, very important thing in departments, and they're never given up without severe struggle. And of course, I don't mean to appear entirely cynical about this, but there are also efforts to make the point that, a person whose mind is to be opened and developed should be acquainted with various schools of thought and deal with issues of truth and justice and rightness. And so, I mean, I don't mean to say that there's not a good reason to have a philosophy requirement, but historically, what's kept the philosophy requirement as robust as it is the tradition that the rise of which I described. Yes.
I was wondering, given the conference is focused on redeeming reason, and from my view, many of my colleagues who are in the field of environmental science or in the sciences coming out of Catholic traditions. And the social sciences for that. I find many of them involved with liberation theology as a real mainstay in terms of social action, whether it be environmental or other. Ecofeminism comes out of a great strand of nuns that are involved in this area and have written quite a bit. And so I'm wondering with some of these very, quite extreme, whether it's theologies or social action, when we come to the issue of redeeming reason, can evangelicals and Catholics somehow come together to do this task, and what would it require?
Well, I told you I'm not a philosopher.
I can help that easy.
I really can't speak from any knowledge there. I just don't know. It is certainly true that the religious impulse. Of course, what was happening while the Second Vatican Council was going on was that the American world was in a turmoil, and that the whole of the whole thing was liberation, freedom now, and doing something about the awful state of things, the racism, the imperialism, and militarism. So that the particularly religious women in communities who were urged to go back to their original charism. When they go back to their original charism, they often found that the founders didn't even really intend to start a religious community. They just wanted to live together and teach or help the poor or nurse the sick or something like that. And they were brought into this systematic institutionalization by, not exactly by force, but if they wanted to continue what they're doing, there was a rule to follow. So you get it, you get the rule better. All right, so they go back and they discover, we didn't have to do all these things that we've been doing. We didn't have to wear all these clothes that we were wearing. So let's start over and imagine what our founders would do in this world, right now, if they were here. and it wasn't teaching middle class kids. It wasn't being, you know, teaching in these girls' colleges, some of which were, you know, upper middle class. So that all fed into the enthusiasm and appetite for social action. And my suspicion is that the idea of where philosophy fit into the picture was neglected, almost willfully neglected, because it was there was kind of anti-intellectualism about it. I mean, that was particularly true in the case of the Jesuits. See, in the 1930s, the Jesuits discovered that their colleges in this country were very, very mediocre, and so they launched a major self-study and determined on raising the scholarly and intellectual level of their communities, their personnel. So from the mid to late 30s through into the mid and late 60s, there was really an intellectual elitism in the Jesuit order. And when that left a lot of hewers of wood and drawers of water among the members of the community who were resentful of all this. They didn't get to go to Cambridge. I mean, they went to Catholic U, maybe, or Notre Dame, even. My point is that there was a rejection of the super intellectualized dimension of Catholic activity, thought, and teaching that was part of the reaction to the council. And that rubbed off on philosophy, and it tended to be, you know, absorbed into social action. I think that answers your question. Yes?
Tell the other part of the story that I think most of us evangelicals know is how much the Catholic schools were dominated by, in their teaching style, by religious communities. And when then the religious communities fell apart and started losing members, the Catholic schools then had to hire lay people. Mm-hmm. Then that was another contributing factor here, that most of us don't know that part of the story.
Well, it is certainly the case that the religious communities were by far the dominant element, and as early as the 1920s, the larger institutions tend to be at least half lay persons. The universities, the colleges had a smaller proportion of lay people as opposed to religious. The schools run by the religious sisters had the highest proportion of religious community members as on the faculty, the fewest lay people on the faculty. And the schools run by the sisters were really hit by all sorts of things all at once. The changes in the atmosphere and aspiration and so on connected with the council. The massive loss of personnel, so the exodus from the sisterhoods and from the priesthoods, the priesthood that took place between 1965 and 1980, 75, whatever. And the fact that because the sisters were leaving, they had to hire more lay people. And these schools had always been tuition dependent, still are tuition dependent. The Catholic schools, on the whole, didn't have wealthy benefactors for a long time, and the religious schools that were girls' schools had even less, because if the family was giving money, it would give it to the place where the man went to school, the banker or whoever he was. And then the movement against single-sex education came along at the same time, so that the schools run by the religious sisters were decimated, really. I mean, 40 or 50 of them went out of business altogether. Most of there are maybe a dozen that are still strictly girls' schools. The rest have become co-ed, and a good many have been absorbed by others. Like in Chicago here, Mundelein was taken over by Loyola, allegedly as a partnership, but it just disappeared in no time. And then there was another, even smaller, Catholic girls' school up in Willamette called Malincroft, which was also taken over by Loyola. So the situation of the sisters was very great. In the men's schools, they too were hard hit by the loss, by the exodus from the priesthood and the religious life. And hard hit not only because this was a personnel matter, but it's a morale matter. I mean, you see people whose lives have been dedicated in a special way, vowed to religion, and all at once they decide they're not doing it anymore. Well, what does that tell you? I mean, it's not really encouraging to see that happen. But loss of religious personnel meant, of course, more lay people had to take over, and as far as Catholic universities were concerned, this kind of came pretty close to meshing with what you might call an inventory crisis as far as faculty availability was concerned. That is to say, all at once around 1970, 71, people discovered that there were way more applicants than there were jobs in those fields. Still exists in a lot of fields. Now, what that meant was that Catholic institutions that were besieged by, if they had an opening, they were besieged by people with degrees from Harvard or Princeton or California or Chicago or Michigan or whatever, who probably wouldn't have been, looking for jobs at St. Meinrad, say, 10 years earlier. So that the availability of people from the secular institutions multiplied at the same time that Catholics were working out from under their older view. And that brought in a lot of people who had very little sympathy with, or not necessarily a lot of sympathy with, the religious goals of the university. And Catholic institutions were determined to make themselves big time, and that meant be really professional. What you're looking for is academic scholarship, research, results. So you hire on the basis of scholarship. We don't want to go back to the old parochial way of we hire Catholics only. See? And so departments and Catholic institutions were at the same time becoming more self-governing. There was a liberation in higher education with everybody had to be represented on all sorts of councils and everything in the 60s and 70s and continues. Basically, in the larger institutions, hiring, at least as far as initial selection of candidates, is a departmental function. And if the department is full of people who say, we don't need all these Catholics, my God, we've got Catholics all over the place, let's get some scholars here. Well, I mean, it doesn't take long for, the whole texture of the operation to be affected by that kind of attitude. And that did happen. And that's part of what there was a reaction against, to go back to the question you raised at the beginning, a reaction against in the sense that, we can't just assume that this is going to take care of itself. We have to be purposeful in our hiring and what we do on these things. I'm sure that didn't answer the question.
One more question?
Yes.
I don't know whether this is an appropriate question, but I'm not sure if it's live, but it seems to me that the work of St. Augustine was one of the great, that he was able to show how truth is viewed in a beautiful way. And then from my perspective, with Aquinas, after Augustine's thinking might have been returned away later, just is actually modernism in from my perspective, but my question is, has there been any return to the Augustinian kind of city study or community here in New York or in the United States?
Well, I can't really answer that question. Except to say that in anything comparable to the way St. Thomas was absolutely nothing, no. Now, at Villanova, you'd have that because that's an Augustine, there was an Augustine order of St. Augustine that operates the place. I don't know whether or not there's anything self-conscious about that or not. But I simply don't know. It's not the kind of thing I have any knowledge of. Well, thank you very much, sir.